Hello. In episode 10 of Airs for Architecture's third series, I spoke with Catherine Bonn and André Villian, partners at Bonn and Villian Architects, but for this conversation, authors of two books, Continuous Productive Urban Landscapes, published by Elsevier in 2004, and Second Nature Urban Agriculture, published by Routledge in 2014.
Airs for Architecture, a podcast about architecture, buildings, urban culture, and space.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Airs for Architecture. I'm talking today to Catherine Bonn and André Villian. Catherine, André, would you be so kind as to introduce yourself?
Okay, my pleasure. My name is Catherine, as Ambrose already introduced. I'm an architect by training, but since more than 20 years, I'm working also as an urban designer. An urban practitioner, as I call it often. And together with André, and I think this will be the subject of today's podcast, together with André, I have been working since, also about 20 years on design strategies that aim to improve urban food systems. And I lost my sentence, so this needs to be cut out already.
No, I'm not going to cut that out. That's fine. That's just humans talking. So what's an urban practitioner? How would you define an urban practitioner? What leads one? How does one get to be an urban practitioner?
It's not my invention. So there are a number of urban practitioners around. And what I like about the term is that it creates openness as to what I'm actually doing. As an architect, if I tell you I'm an architect, you immediately have a certain picture in your mind as to what I'm doing, which is probably building houses or schools or hospitals, and wearing a hard hat, and sitting at a drawing board. And this is not at all how my practice as an architect has developed over the last 20 years. So I much more fall into a category which is maybe also called alternative practice in architecture, where basically the fact that I hopefully have a certain spatial understanding, but also an organizational understanding, leads to me being involved much more in processes that probably on a large in general relate to spatial appropriation, to changes in spatial usages, to proposals of how space in general can be used more sustainably. And that space then is not only architectural in a traditional sense. It could be buildings. It could be surfaces off on buildings, but it could also be open spaces in the city, subjects that traditionally would maybe be much rather related to urban planners. And then the other interesting thing I think about our practice is that we practice and we are practical. So in this area that André and myself are going to describe, we would plant vegetables, for example, or we would engage with local communities and we would sit in workshops and meetings. So a type of practice that is encompassing more than what we traditionally would associate with architecture, I guess. So
That's really wonderful. That's a lovely way of describing it. We can come back to that through the framework of these books and this paper that you sent me. But André, how do you follow that?
I'm also an architect, and my background is in, always an interest in kind of alternative architecture, but in, for example, the old solar energy movement from the 1970s and all the rest. But in parallel to that, an interest in iconic sort of pieces of architecture from the 20th century. You know, I mean, I became an architect at school, actually, in South Africa. I can still remember seeing this first picture of the Villa Savoye in Helen Gardner's History of Art in, I don't know, 1975 or something. And at that point, in that kind of South African context where I grew up, the whole idea of modernism and modern art were, of course, seen as very radical and kind of tied in to a whole idea of opposition to apartheid and all of these things, just in the sense of another world was kind of possible. So I came to architecture really through an interest, I suppose, mainly in kind of, well, at that, like, this is at school, but like in painting and stuff, and then seeing architecture and always being interested in kind of construction and physics and things like that as well. But anyway, so I studied then in Dublin, in Bolton Street, a very practical school of architecture. It's now Dublin Technical University. And then I was also involved in self-built boats and catamarans, somebody called James Warham and Hanneke Boon. But anyway, I sort of ended up then working in somewhere called the Low Energy Architecture Research Unit, which was an early research centre at the University of North London. And that would have been in the 90s. And that was a point when North London actually had a really rich mix of practitioners, really curated by somebody called Helen Mallinson, who was the head of the school. So we had Caruso St. John, we had C.J. Lim teaching, Florian Bagel was a professor. So there's a real culture of people talking about design. And there were also then, for example, the Low Energy Architecture Research Unit, which was run by people called Yvonne Dean and somebody called Mike Wilson. And Yvonne Dean had been really involved in alternative practices, like feminist practices, and bringing in different people to learn access to architecture. So anyway, through that whole kind of, the more I think about it, reflect on it, it was that whole kind of culture really there was really stimulating. And it was both stimulating, and plus it also made you want to engage and kind of, you know, demonstrate what you were interested in. Mm. And yeah, and then there was always this conflict between low energy architecture being sort of boring and high architecture, you know, having no constraints.
Mm.
Though interestingly, and I won't go on too long, but interestingly, sort of in parallel to the North London studying, I was doing some teaching at East London, which is where Katrine and I met, doing a master's in sustainable architecture. And that was a point when Peter Salter became head of school there. And Peter Salter was somebody who we'd sort of heard about in Dublin, mm-hmm. but it was all quite mysterious, and, you know, the sort of work that was being produced. And what I found really interesting with Peter Salter was he was as interested in low energy architecture as, you know, those of us working in that field, you know, it is, but he was interested in the architectural kind of consequences of it as well. So there was a whole, just at that point, there was a whole interesting coming together of interest in low energy architecture, architecture with sort of capital A, and people talking about it, and the sort of educational environment really facilitated discussion, which I think now, at least in my context at Brighton, that is becoming increasingly limited as the whole process becomes much more sort of managerially driven. Sorry, that's a long ramble.
No, it's really good. I mean, it's really good background. I think that's a really interesting thing. There's a couple of things that both of you have talked about, which is this idea of alternative practice or architecture, not in the traditional sense, as you said, Katrine, which But I think a lot of people, when people think about alternative practice, they tend to think about sort of radical practice, feminist practice, interventionist practice. But this idea of energy efficiency as a radical practice is I think quite interesting, because it's not that newer. I think for young trainee architects, the idea that that would be radical would be quite surprising, because that's what we all think about now. But then it was quite a break with the, as you say, break with the kind of canon of architecture.
Was it, and that was also the time when, for example, the first climate change reports were coming out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the RIBA were hosting workshops and meetings discussing reports from the IPCC and all of this. So, you know, it was coming onto the table. But certainly not accepted, you know, and still there was this real kind of problem with the idea of constraints, you know, that how can we be constrained by these concerns? But go on.
No, Katrine, you had your hand.
Yeah, I just noticed something which I myself haven't really explored before, but that just the way you formulated your questions, it's true that we talk about alternative and we talk about radical, and so did you. And obviously they are not the same. Yeah. So, I find that quite interesting to, I don't know that it is the right thing to do right now, but to explore more, what is it actually that we mean with alternative, and is alternative the same as radical? Obviously it's not, yeah? So the idea of finding an alternative, this is maybe what we both were interested in, Andre and myself, and we may ask ourselves why actually are we looking for alternatives, yeah? And then the question is really, must be asked, does the alternative need to be radical? And how radical does an alternative need to be? So what actually, why does it happen, to say it differently, that we also would like to see the alternative as being radical? Yeah. And at least for me, I think that also highlights a bit the backgrounds where I come from. And I do think that I come indeed also from a environmental, societal ambition, which is to, basically use my time and energy and enthusiasm in architecture in order to contribute to this creation of the better place, basically. Mm-hmm. And the better place meaning one that is environmentally friendly and that is socially adept and that is beautiful. Yeah. So I'm probably much more interested in the alternative. And if it turns out that the alternative has to be radical, then be it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and that's something which.
That's a really interesting kind of sort of fissure to separation to kind of open up, because I think those two words are used, they're quite slippery, aren't they? Radical and alternative. And I think it's quite easy to see them both as meaning essentially the same thing, which defangs both of them as concepts. The reason we are speaking today, other than the fact that you're wonderful and you do great work, is that I spoke with my colleague Silvio Caputo at the Kent School of Architecture, and I asked him, because obviously Silvio, who I think you know, he looks at urban agriculture and urban food systems, and I said to him, who would be the best people in the world to speak to about urban food? It's one of the themes that we're running in our master's program in the coming year. He's co-running a unit in the master's program on this. And he said, well, Katrine and Andre. So I looked up your work and I came across this idea of edible cities. And I wrote to you, and you wrote back and you suggested two books and a paper. You sent me a paper. The books, and I would like to get to kind of like the origins of these books, because I think we're this perhaps slightly slow or seemingly slow introduction is helps kind of create some foundations for this. But the first book that you suggested was your book, which you edited, called CPULs, or Continuous Productive Urban Landscapes, Designing Urban Agriculture for Sustainable Cities, which was published by Architectural Press in 2005, I think. Yeah, 2005. And then the second one was Second Nature Urban Agriculture, Designing Productive Cities. And that was published by Routledge in, 2014, I think. I think that's what it says. Yeah, 2014. And then there's a paper with no date on it, by the way. So I don't know if it came before or afterwards, but it's got a kind of catchy title. So I'm thinking it's more recent, called The Edible City, Envisioning the Continuous Productive Urban Landscape. So
2011.
Mm-hmm. Ah, right. I see. So that came, that foregrounds the book. And I just wanted to better understand, I suppose, the motivations, the origins of this, and how this idea, and perhaps we should obviously start by defining the CPULs, Continuous Productive Urban Landscapes, how this idea has emerged and where it stands now in your own work. Who wants to start on that? Don't be too polite.
No. Well, I mean, I could say a little bit about where emerged, how it emerged. For a definition, so the continuous productive urban landscape, we refer to the concept as a CPUL, which is just the sort of acronym CPUL, CPUL, which actually is using a slight German pronunciation for that, as opposed to CPUL or sort of CPUL. Anyway, CPUL. But the CPUL, it's basically a proposition which says it would be sensible to coherently integrate networks of open space within cities, within urban environments, that could connect to the hinterland beyond the cities. But within these networks of open spaces, where appropriate, there would be food production. There would be urban agriculture sites. Katrine, you might want to say that more clearly or succinctly, or is that enough?
Entirely clear, I feel.
Yeah, okay. And then I'll just say, I mean, for me, where the idea came from, and then maybe, you know, Katrine can pick up. But so for me, it came very clearly from that period at North London, actually, when there was a lot of discussion in the late 90s, sort of about infrastructural urbanism and things like this. And I got interested in the idea of ecological footprint, which was this concept put forward by two Canadian geographers, Wagenagel and Rees, who wrote a book called Ecological Footprint, which is a very kind of popular, almost cartoon-like publication, but it just started mapping in spatial terms the impact of different human activities, so how much land was needed for things. And it kind of led then to this idea of, you know, whatever it is, we need 3.5 Earths to support current living standards if everybody had the same standard. Anyway, and what became clear from that was that food had a big impact in terms of area, and that's also linked to, there was a project that Stan Allen did for a competition in Barcelona where he described this idea of patchy city, and he had this drawing which showed some of sort of squares like you'd find in Barcelona, or quarters, some of agricultural, some built, and that actually was quite that was a kind of spark for me to think about what would it be like if you had agriculture in the city. And what appealed to me about it was that, one, it could work environmentally, but two, it had this kind of Dada-like sort of absurd idea to it, but also that actually just the experience, like in the Netherlands, sometimes if you in some of the villages right up next to farmland, that is actually a very rich experience. So it just struck me that it was kind of interesting, and it would be, could produce an interesting environment. And also quite sort of important in my mind was the idea that, so architects, sort of capital A architects, and, you know, I've wanted to do capital A architecture as well. I mean, I like how you design a window or how you place something, or, you know, the things that architects are interested in, the formal sort of spatial aspect. But so whilst architects really weren't interested in low energy architecture at that point, apart from people like Sergius and Bates, who just did it and it was interesting, landscape wasn't like a threat to architecture. And so I thought that actually maybe this idea of urban agriculture and the productive urban landscapes could also be a way to kind of build a much more fruitful and positive dialogue between sort of architecture and low energy architecture. So that was one way, that was quite an important sort of idea at the back of my mind. I don't think we really wrote about that ever, but that sort of led to the idea. And then the other thing was, we didn't want to make a manifesto, you know, the sort of, I think, you know, the architect, you know, I've had a great idea, this is the answer. So we did a lot of work, which is in the first Siepel's book, trying to see if objectively there was a case into environmental terms for organic agriculture in the city to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions. And then we used architectural competitions as a way to just take a brief for a project and see if you could include urban agriculture in that. And we did a Europan in what year? Can you remember which year it was, Katrine?
In 1998.
Eight, yeah. And we were runners up in that project. So anyway, we used competitions to try and test these ideas architecturally to see if you could actually integrate the urban agriculture with a design, you know, that had other requirements. And I think in one of your questions you sort of suggested that we might speak about today was, what do we mean by design, like an urban design strategy for the Siepel idea? And in a way, that's what it means to me. I mean, just, you know, can you integrate, could you integrate these productive spaces, urban agriculture, in ways that they don't detract from other activities in the city? But yeah, I mean, and then, yeah, and then we did a lot of field work in Cuba and different places. We did exhibitions working with some Cuban artists and the English artist Tom Phillips, who was interested in all this stuff. Yeah, but sorry, maybe Katrine can.
Yeah, Katrine, I mean, what is the lineage of this? I suppose that's it sort of seems to me to a little bit fit within a regular discourse within modernism around the deficits of urban life, I suppose, industrial and now post-industrial urban life. Do you see this, these Siepels, as a kind of continuation of that?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And I probably wouldn't have formulated like that. And it comes again back to this idea of the alternative, yeah, or the radical. And I completely agree with everything that Andre did say. Yeah, but maybe then with reference to your question, this is maybe where for us this idea of infrastructure came in, and of the continuous, in the continuous productive urban landscape. And maybe also for myself, one of the main deficits in our current urban life, as I would have seen it around the turn of the century, would have been how people use the city and urban space, city space, on a daily basis, which has both to do with traffic, but also with how to overcome distance, yeah, and with the richness and the beauty of the experience. Yeah, so that was something that between us, Andre and myself, we would be discussing a lot. Yeah, so there was this idea of what could be measures in order to, in a low energy sense, lower our ecological footprint. Yeah, but then there were also these thoughts we had as to, at the end, we like living in a city, but we would like to have a city which is more beautiful and which is more amenable to alternative ways of moving around. Basically, often also non-car alternatives. Yeah. So, and that I remember that, and I do really like the memory that we would walk through London, basically our Southeast London. At that time, I was still living in London. Yeah. Walking around London and in a very practical sense, trying to imagine what would it be like if city development either had been different to what it was or could be readapted in a infrastructurally, indeed, actually quite radical way, which is we would search for back roads, we would search for open spaces, railway embankments, these type of spaces, trying to imagine, and then we would visualize that in collages at a time when Photoshop wasn't really developed yet. Yeah, we would try to envision, so what would it be like if one had a city that instead of car parking spaces, four lane traffic jams, would have these punctually inserted and designed open spaces. So I still can get incredibly excited about that. Yeah. And for me, it's still a vision of the modern city. Yeah. And again,
I think that's a really interesting point, because I think when people think of agriculture, obviously it's sort of antithetical to the city, but the city is very attractive for a host of reasons, not least as you use the word exciting. Cities are exciting. Farms are not very exciting. I've worked on farms. They're not very exciting. And it's hard work. So but it comes back to another point that you were making also, Andre, which is this idea of design. Are you maybe one of the things that would be worth trying to do is describing what this might look like in your first book, Continuous Productive Urban Landscapes, Sepals, you have early on this diagram of London where you've just taken these
London
and these pathways through it, and this is like immediately to me, because I like reading maps, it speaks of something. But what does it look like? Can you describe it? Is there something?
Well, there are a couple of ways to try and describe it. So, do you want me to talk about that drawing or just how we would imagine the sepal?
Well,
or the collage.
Yeah. I mean,
the collage.
However you fancy.
Yeah. So I mean that collage, which is a very significant piece of work, at least for me. So the idea of that was twofold. I mean, it was done. That was done, I think, between 1997 or five, or I don't know, seven or something like that. Anyway, but so the idea was, if you were to feed. If you were to supply all of London with fruit and vegetables based on the yield you would get from a well-managed allotment, and not like super efficient or anything, but and at that point London had a population of 7 million, and the general sort of rule of thumb from allotment was that you need 100 square meters, 10 meters by 10 meters, to feed a person. So I just multiplied whatever that is, you know, 100 square meters by 7 million, and you get an area. And then I printed that area to the same scale as an A to Z London map that we had. But had this really nice book from the 1930s on how to grow your own vegetables, which are these beautiful little line drawings of vegetables, and used that to represent the urban agriculture areas. And then literally just cut London into strips and inserted these strips of food growing, which together, the area of those equated to the area that you would need if London got all the fruit and veg from allotment. And the idea in my head, I just wanted to see was like, how much bigger would London need to be? Like, it was to test whether the idea had some plausibility, you know, would you need like 10 times the area? And what surprised me about it was, well, you had to get bigger, but not like impossibly bigger. So it sort of suggested that actually this idea could be plausible, because that's what we were trying to work out for ourselves and definitely convince people. And then the other thing was just to take that map literally. You know, just imagine you had this strip of agriculture and one of them happened to sort of cut sort of through Green Park and sort of past Buckingham Palace and Victoria Station. And you just imagined it. And I just thought, well, actually, that would be really interesting. But if you ask of examples of what these spaces would be like, the continuous productive urban landscape. So the one example we often would give would be, say, imagine Venice, but with the canals as fields. You know, instead of the canals, that's a continuous productive urban landscape. So in a way, that's quite an easy way. And what's nice about that is that you can see that you could have these networks of open space and retain an urban setting. And then the other example, which at least for people in the UK is probably a fairly easy one. Well, it depends whether you've been there or not, but is Central Park within Manhattan. The way that Central Park sits as an open space, which is really large in a very dense area, but taking into account the fact that Manhattan is really like a tiny city because it's so narrow. And I mean, what really surprised me about Manhattan was how it had a sort of a seapool quality to it, because basically you have the avenues running, whatever, I probably got the wrong way around. But anyway, if you look north-south, you're in an urban environment. Mm. If you look east-west, you can always look out and you can see one of the rivers, and you can see, as it were, the landscape. So it's that form of Manhattan is one way of trying to imagine what a seapool would be like. And we did some little collage project where we just extend Manhattan extend the street pattern and then have an area of productive landscape and another area. It's like a series of strips. And that goes back to what Katrine and you were talking about, you know, what we absolutely didn't want with the seapool idea was that we are producing some kind of suburbia. So you know, the idea was that this needed to be kind of an urban environment. But equally, the intention wasn't that everybody would grow their own food in it, and the intention wasn't that we would claim that the city could feed itself completely from the productive landscape. So a lot of our early work in the Seapools book was about trying to work out, like, what yields could you get? And we came to the conclusion you could get about 25% or something of your fruit and vegetable requirements using conventional organic agriculture. You know, this is not hydroponic systems with LEDs in enclosed buildings, which were vertical farms, which Dixon Despommier, who in fact we interviewed for the second book, started advocating and has been advocating. Yeah, but so pictures, Venice with the canals as the sea pool.
Yeah.
And that contrast or the relationship in Manhattan between the open space of Central Park and the built up areas, you know, to each side of it, and how you have that interplay. And I find it really interesting, you know, almost like a little theatre set, where especially like in Central Park also, you know, if you look north-south, you're in nature, in inverted commas. If you look east-west, you're in the city. And so that's what interests me about one aspect of this productive urban landscape.
I really like it. And there's this lovely vignette that you describe at the beginning where you kind of give an example, you describe what this might look like practically processually, you know, as a process, as an urban process. And it's about describing a new way of having that urban experience, as I read it anyway. It's not, I mean, so we have things like the High Line, and as you say, in New York and Central Park, and we have that lovely web of parks across North Central London as well, you know, Regent Park and Hyde Park and Green Park and so on and so forth. And that sort of you could imagine that, but they very much sit within a kind of an older idea of the city, which is something to do with leisure, something to do with a kind of social hierarchies. Imperialism certainly plays a part in the definition of Central London and its open spaces. Mercantile culture and so on and so forth. But the world that you're describing here, this future scenario that you're describing, is exciting, but it's different exciting. It's a new kind of idea of urban life, civil society, civic life. And I wondered whether you might want to speak a little bit about that, like how do we imagine this occurring organizationally, like how do we make this more likely to occur within the context of our current social situation? Like what moves do we make to even get this going?
Actually, interestingly, the spatial side of this continuous productive urban landscape design strategy, this is already something different to imagine from other, let's say, urban planning concepts. Yeah, but if it comes to the organizational issues, societal, the societal knitting in of these landscapes, then that we noticed working through it is actually much more radical than what may think on first sight. Yeah. So, and to detail this a bit, for me, one important aspect is also the question of scale. And this is also the beauty of this idea of thinking about these productive urban landscapes. They have this infrastructural scale, as Andre describes it. They also have a very personal scale. They could, in theory, and maybe in practice, they could affect everybody living in the city. Yeah. And that is interesting, and it's frightening, and it is often also leading people to objecting to the idea of urban agriculture full stop. Yeah, because there's not always enthusiasm in people when they think that I personally have to rethink my way of feeding myself in the city. Yeah, not everybody takes that as positively as we may do, and you say the farm is boring as well. Yeah, so that actually is something that not only us but a whole lot of people who are active in this urban agriculture and food systems discourse are thinking about. Yeah, and one maybe interesting practical way of imagining it is the urban farmer. Yeah, so Andre already said that never we would have proposed that everybody in the city must become a farmer. Yeah, yet in order to manage these agricultural spaces, which are not allotments, I mean, you are right, we are thinking about leisure a lot when we think about the sepals, but in terms of producing food and quantities that are sufficient to even only feed people to 25% with fruit and veg, you need professionals. Yeah, so you need professionals that tend the fields, that harvest, that plant, that collect, that process, that distribute. It's an industry in itself. Yeah, and if you look at the original urban agricultural definition by Jack Smith and Joe Nather in 1996, I think. That's how they described agriculture also as an industry. Yeah. And if one continues thinking about that, which is not really architecture, but which falls into the remit of designing for urban agriculture, then you notice how radically the thinking actually has to be if you really want it permanently or at least long lastingly integrate these spaces for food growing. Yeah. So you need an urban farmer. You need a new type of machinery, because in the dense city, you couldn't work with what you may see on industrialized agricultural fields. You need distribution systems which are much more localized. Yeah. And you need consumers who are also willing to buy the produce. Yeah. Mm. Which, as you can imagine, as we know from the organic movement, is very likely at a higher price than what you may buy in the local supermarket. So it's an incredibly complex. It's an incredibly complex system that we tapped into by starting to think spatially about what would it be like if one were to produce more food in the city. And if you start thinking about it systemically, i.e. primarily around the food system, then it becomes really radical if it were to be followed through to the full extent in our current dense European style cities.
But I think there's another point just to pick up on that, which is interesting, which is so if you have the urban agriculture spaces in the city, they can operate in different levels. So for example, when we started this work, it was when Cuba was in this economic crisis after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And we did quite a bit of work there. And they would have commercial, effectively market gardens in the city, which they called organoponicos. And there's one photograph which is in the Sepals book, which is quite an important one for us, which is from a city of Cienfuegos, which is basically it's a square which was surrounded by four housing blocks from the 70s or so, prefabricated blocks. And then in the middle, in the square, which probably used to be a parking lot or something, is a market garden with these strips of really intensely cultivated organic agriculture. And so that's a curated piece of ground. And what I thought is really interesting about that is it provides this visual environment for the inhabitants around it who are not farmers. But it's just like when we go to the countryside and we enjoy looking at the countryside, there's that same effect. And Katrine did a really nice project in Berlin, in Matsan, where it's also a housing area with a urban agriculture field and just some footpaths that run through it. So these commercial fields provide sort of ancillary benefits to the population, residents, who are not farmers. But for that to work, the farmers would need to be paid properly. Yeah, and that's one of the big problems. Yeah, that it and obviously, and that also goes into how we value land. So the other idea we talk about quite a lot is the idea of trying to convince ourselves that open space in cities should be thought of as a central infrastructure. And since we did all this work, that side of the thinking has moved on a lot, you know, in terms of green infrastructure, ecological corridors, all of that. When we started the work, that, you know, people were not, that wasn't on the agenda. I mean, it wasn't being discussed. So at the moment, at least the idea of putting in networks of landscaped space into cities is not radical. I mean, the reality, of course, if you look in the UK or London or somewhere, is highly challenging. And then there's another kind of space which is much more the kind of space that people occupy adjacent to food growing space. And probably, I don't know if Katrine would agree, but probably the most, an exemplary example of that, well, in Berlin would be somewhere which is called Prinzessinnengarten. It's changed a little bit, but it had a number of years as a kind of social gathering space, including a food growing space, and a kind of a space for gathering, which operates just like I think that introductory chapter to the Sepals book that Katrine wrote about walking through a Sepal in the summer and in the winter. So there are these two aspects in terms of how these kinds of spaces can interact and contribute to the city. And old Tom Phillips spoke about, I mean, we spoke a lot about ornament, and urban agriculture is a form of kind of organic ornament. He wrote a treaty on ornament quite a few years back, and he has some definitions about like how you draw ornament, and he uses words like repetition, hatch, branching, forking, and all those words describe exactly what you would see in a market garden effectively. So that's the other sort of one, you know, another aspect that again I find really interesting.
Very rewarding sort of area to start playing around in. I'm very conscious of time. I would love to talk about the impacts of these sepals on the way that architecture then performs on its boundaries. I'm very interested. It's the sort of permacultural principle of, you know, borders are creative. If you put these sepals through, you would immediately create this discourse between urban fabric and farming fabric and the forms of leisure. But we have very few minutes before Katrine, more interested to go, but I would like to kind of understand how the architect operates in this context. So if we've got this kind of model that you're both architects, so you both know how architecture works, and it's kind of it's been going for quite a long time. I don't know if it's a very effective method of practice. It certainly doesn't seem to be supplying architects with very decent salaries, but it doesn't seem to be supplying us with very good cities either. So it's kind of arguably, how does an architect in this model operate? And I want to come back to the very beginning where you talked about alternative practice. Does the architect essentially become, or what do you describe yourself as, an urban practitioner? Is this new idea, like you are an activist, you instigate programs, you act small and scale up, or is there still opportunities for a big client to come in and point to the big architect and say, give us a plan? And bill us as you normally do.
Can I ask another question? Can you show me the image that you you said there is one map that you liked, just to double check that we described the right one?
Well, it was interesting actually. This was the one that I was talking about.
Oh, okay.
And then this is the one that you talked about.
So I was.
That's interesting because the first one is Katrine's drawing.
Yeah,
and the second one was
This one is Katrine's, is it?
Yeah. And I was even thinking you may have been speaking about yet another one. So this is what I wanted to actually meant. Yeah. So we.
I think the conversation works for both actually, and I particularly like the way that Andre was talking about Venice, which is all sinuous and alluvial and so on, and then this mapping exercise, which is about. It's actually got there's a very early Rem Koolhaas project. I think it was his thesis, in which he designs a city split like this. I think it's a fascinating, fascinating idea.
Yeah, yeah, that it's based on Berlin, actually, isn't it? If I understand it, that project. Anyway,
yeah,
yeah,
yeah. So, yeah, that's interesting. So, I may at some point give you a little text on that image that you actually, that drawing that you actually picked. But also, back to your question, where the architecture comes in and where the architect comes in, which are again two different things. Yeah. So, I would say that. But sometimes one speaks about an urban agriculture movement, indeed, yeah, something that has developed over the last 20 years in several countries around the world, starting from North America, traveling into Europe, coming in via the Netherlands, spreading to the UK, spreading to the rest of Europe, etc. And interestingly, a lot of the urban agriculture movement is actually being led by architects. So not by landscape architects, not by urban planners, but for some reason, it seems to be something that architects, A, were fascinated with, and B, were also able to look at with sufficient naivety in order to move the discourse on. Yeah. So this is how I explain it to me, that architects were at the forefront of this this movement, including ourselves, yeah, without being either farmers nor planners nor landscape architects, but being able to deal and work with different inputs and with different demands that come from the spatial side, from the social side, issues like obesity, issues like watering infrastructure, and we could somehow, or luckily, were able to fit that sufficiently together to make this case for urban agriculture. Yeah, so I find that interesting that architects, A, were in it from the beginning, but B, again, not in their traditional capacity of building houses. Yeah. And I would argue this is still the case. So if architects engage with urban agriculture, they engage with it much as you described it in your brief words, you know, which is participatory working, being the activist. I still feel that often that I'm the activist. I'm just starting a new project in a small town in Germany, where basically the idea is to hopefully convince the city to become an edible city, but starting with a community garden. Yeah. And this is another thing you picked up, that when we started to work on the subject area, there was indeed also no interest in large scale planned thinking about productive urban spaces in the sense that they are food productive. So we early on thought, and not only us, I mean, internationally, other urban agriculture enthusiasts, we started with this punctual idea. One has to create projects. One has to create visual examples of what these cities could be like. Yeah, so it was an activist approach. It was an art-based approach. Our early projects were all funded by arts organizations. It was a lot of work, basically, where, again, also the artist as somebody who tries to think alternatively was at the forefront of this development. Yeah, and in terms of architecture, I think maybe the most interesting development is that urban agriculture started as an open field planting idea. Yeah, not only us, but also elsewhere in the UK and Canada and France. And then it moved into rooftop farming, for example, yeah, or vertical farming. And this is where I see the most benefit in terms of how architecture and urban agriculture can spatially in buildings liaise. And I would say that the pioneers on that front currently is France and Paris, who have indeed set up a rooftop program where I can't remember how many thousand square meters of roof surface are being transformed into food productive spaces, green spaces in general. Yeah. So I find that
fantastic.
But I think, yeah.
Andre.
No, it's okay. So I mean it's also like in parallel to these projects Katrine's talking about. You know, there's a lot of work around policy stuff. I mean, Katrine's been doing a lot of work in Germany with food policy councils, and I've started doing a little bit of work with a team in Brighton, the city, Brighton and Hove City Council, looking at food systems and trying to embed these ideas into the discourse. But I think what we can see, at least what you can see in just the London situation anyway, is that, you know, when Katrine and I started this work, it was sort of, in the UK context, it was kind of seen as interesting, you know, like interesting idea. But, you know, the fact now that like the Hackney School of Food, this little project by Sermon Weston, I don't know if you know this project in London, very simple, but very beautiful and very effective, or projects by Practice Architecture that are at this stage, some of them are still speculative, but they're all linked around food. So it's getting onto the agenda, but it's a really slow process. And the challenge of getting it into policy, which is really important, that's a lot of ongoing work. And there are other practices, you know, who've been working on this kind of in the background, but significantly, like, for example, Ash Sakula, the practice in London, who are, have always been interested in this idea. And
I wanted to finish that transition from the ground-based open field agriculture. I wanted to also finish this from our perspective. We recently noticed that we are working in this field now for about 30 years. Yeah. Or 25. And if we then cluster our work into, let's say, so 8 to 10 year blocks, then the first block was this idea of making the case for urban architecture, i.e. first of all, identifying it as an opportunity for cities and trying to convince the public, but also decision makers, that it is a good idea ourselves. Yeah. Then we had another block of 8 to 10 years where actually, as we said earlier, we trialed what could this be like, competitions, art-based projects, installations, exhibitions, yeah, this type of work, which was very small scale and which was very much to create visual examples of space that is inhabited by plants, by edible plants, and by humans. But very interestingly, step by step, you know, spending a long time and a lot of our career basically on this, we are now in a third block so far that we are working with local councils to implement strategies in a variety of senses that do improve local food systems on a spatial basis. So, and this is, as Andre also just said, this is just emerging. A lot of this is still speculative. A lot of it isn't implemented. But after that stretch of time, the idea of improving a city's sustainability by improving its access to food has actually has fallen onto how do we say? Sorry, we have to cut this out again. I'm missing a bit. You know, has become. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah, it's becoming part of the mainstream. It's becoming part of
the mainstream. And that it is such a long process. And it is not, again, it is not how we usually practice as architects, where we have a client and we develop a project and it is being implemented, or probably it's not implemented. So we have basically now spent 25, 30 years. But I would say with the big, big, big success that there are now local councils, yeah, or housing associations, also large-scale housing associations, or, as Andre says, architectural competitions, architectural demand that actively and proactively include these food-producing elements into their work. So that, it takes a long time, but that's how it is.
For sure. I mean the project I was thinking of with Rem Koolhaas is his Exodus project from 1972, where he cuts this giant swathe through. But when you were talking, Katrine, it reminded me, and also you, Andre, it reminded me of Oswald Unger's Berliner Green Archipelago, where you've got this idea to begin with of small scale pepper potting of interventions, yeah, which over time would join up through, I suppose, organic processes of, yeah, urban growth. And I suppose that might be, yeah, that's sort of your second phase, isn't it? That's your second kind of thing. But now that policy has become involved, still they will be working at these smaller scales towards a kind of rhizomatically, like grassroots. Slowly they'll join up till you've got these things, and in a way, they will have been voted for by, yes, the public through the simple act of use, which is kind of utilizing consumer behavior. Like people will, yes, go to them, and then they will be. And I quite like this because I'm always very wary of top-down, yes, processes. They tend to fail. They don't make for happy people. They instrumentalize the poor. Yeah. So on and so forth.
Yeah, and that makes it incredibly complex, but it makes it incredibly exciting. And I agree entirely. And this is also what, at least me, but hopefully Andre agrees, I always found this as a chance in designing for urban agriculture, that it leaves space, mm-hmm, for participation. And it really demands participation, and it doesn't work without participation, because even if you burn it down to only one element, you need people to buy that produce that you produce in the city. If it's just that, yeah. So, and that, I do find this is a big, big opportunity for urban life, yeah, and for the quality of urban life, and also for something that I do think many people are very willing and happy and keen in doing, which is to engage themselves in the setup and formulation of the spaces they live in. And this is where probably the urban agriculture movement also has the biggest impact, in this sense of enabling participation and, yeah, demanding participation.
That is a beautiful point to finish on, and a wonderful high point, giving us, I think, an elegant narrative arc. Thank you so very much, Katrine and Andre. I've really, really enjoyed hearing you speak.
Yeah, no, it's been really nice. I've enjoyed it as well, just, yeah, to reflect on,
yes,
it all again.
Very much so.
Forget city beautiful. How about city delicious? Thanks to Katrin and Andre for taking the time to speak with me. It was great, was it not? See the podcast description for links to their respective practice and academic profiles, and to the books too. You should probably get them. And thanks for listening.